with the approach of Shavuos, I remind some of you and teach others of you of the famous medrash, the famous rabbinic metaphor, which existed at the time of trying to explain why we Jews got stuck with the Torah. God sort of bandied around as a salesman, as a traveling salesman, unto all the nations, and he came to one nation, and they asked, they were told, "Will you accept the Torah?" Whereupon they asked, "What's in it?" And they said, "We can't just take it like that." And the answer was, "Well, it says, chief among everything, lo tignov, you shouldn't be a ganav." "I'm sorry, we can't be a ganav, then we go out of business." Well, it goes to the next nation. What does it say in it? Lo tigzol, you shall not be thieves. What are you talking about? We are highwaymen. The next nation, lo tinaf, you shall not commit adultery. Nonsense. Oh, for such things we don't need you. Until finally the Jews got it by default. Whereupon, knowing the Jews and how loyal they are to things and concepts, Rabbanu Shalom asked for a guarantee. Once you accept it, I want to know what the guarantee is. He said, "Well, we'll guarantee on the, we'll stake the reputation of Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov." He said, don't give me your yichus. And I said, "All right, so we'll give you Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Valeah," and so on down the line, until finally the guarantee that was acceptable was, "Well, if you give me your children, then I will give you the Torah." And that was the guarantee. There have been many books written. Unfortunately, only one has been written as far as a halachic guide to how to raise your child. And it's a part of a life cycle that almost all of us get to without any real how-to books. It's incredible. This medrash is so compelling, and on the other hand, there never has been a book for the mother or for the father, a pamphlet that could be handed to a mother or father and say, "This is the way you're supposed to raise a child al pi halacha." If the child is such an important guarantee to the system, and there is no one sitting around this table that wouldn't deny that, or that would deny that, then my Lord, there's got to be a how-to manual. A year ago Rosh Hashanah, it's going to be almost 2 years, it's going to be 2 years this Rosh Hashanah, I attempted to take all of the sources, and we learned Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, that whole area of time, that entire month or so of time, we learned the obligations of mitzvos in terms of children. What are you supposed to make your children do, and how you're supposed to make your children do it? At that time I did it, at that time, yeah, I hear the whips cracking, which I hear the whips cracking. You see, at that time I started to gather the material, and I hope, please God, that if the summer is very uneventful, the major pamphlet that I will write over the summer will be an accumulation of all of these things. But let me backtrack again, because I believe in my introductions to this subject, there is more compelling information than simply the actual facts. On the one hand, we have been given a license as parents. Kabei des avicha vesimecha, what I say goes because I'm your parent and I pay the bill. But on the other hand, what is not entirely clear to us is that the Torah entrusted us with shaping a personality, with shaping a human being. There isn't one of us who doesn't have his and her hang-ups. There isn't one of us who doesn't have his and her insanities. There isn't one of us who doesn't have his and her flaws in personality. And we don't realize until we have created that other thing, that Picasso of ours, that Rembrandt, that Mona Lisa of ours, that we have transferred all of these flaws, knowingly or unknowingly, we have transferred all of these styles of living to our children. There is no exception. If you claim that you are the perfect human being, well, then you may be the exception. But that's just a claim. And when I talk, I am not talking at you, I am talking to myself and with you. And there are no two ways about it. Gewalt. A child is, after all is said and done, from a biologist's point of view, a clump of meat, a hunk of protoplasm. The care that we take with the meat that we put into the refrigerator, the freezer, the oven, and on our plates is infinitely more strict than what we do with the clump of meat called a little lower than God, the child that we created. If nothing else is gained from this next series, which I think will take two times until we get to Bar Mitzvah and Bat Mitzvah, if you gain nothing else but this knowledge, then Gewalt, that shall have been my reward. Which brings me to my next bit of introduction. We all, as I said before, have our neuroses, our mishigasim. In the Torah community, there is one insanity that is growing more and more pronounced, that is truly a danger. While I agree with my friend Dr. Freud that a personality is completely molded from ages 0 or 1 through 6, and I believe he is entirely correct there, at the same time, if you think that you can take that child, ages 1 through 6, and burden him or her with an adult diet of whatever, then you are crazy. Why? Here you have a 6-year-old whose muscles are not developed yet in hand, back, and foot. Would you ask that child or train that child to lift 300 pounds? That is a burden that adults have got to take, and you need maturation. Nonetheless, from ages 1 through 6, we as parents, again, in our insanity, in our neuroses to excel, to have to be better, if, God forbid, a day goes by and our child hasn't reached a certain level or a certain plateau, he hasn't put on his tzitzis in 1.3798 seconds. There was a hesitation. We all of a sudden come against a crisis in faith. My favorite one these days, if by age 2.5 he is incapable or she is incapable of reciting the Manishtana in 3 languages, Hebrew, English, or Yiddish, you then start to rend your clothes, kriya, oy vey, what did you bless me with? Why did you bless me with such a child? These are insanities, and the kind of insanities that cost lives for Torah as you go along. I have documented it, not in my rabbinic career, but in my educational, psychological career, that trying to feed a child an adult diet of anything, whether it is sitting up at the Seder all night, to eating challah, a shear, you know, it's got to be a size, or drinking the wine, or anything and everything else that you may pull out of the, or God forbid the kid walks around without a yarmulke and he's 2 years old. Lord, why did you bless me? Where? What did I do? What? All of these things are the metal, the stuff, the fabric for destroying religious personalities later on. And here we are, we gave our children as guarantees. Now, there are ways But more importantly, the theme of this next segment is that unlike a time on the calendar or a date within the year, the mitzvah of raising children is a very fluid one. Some are ready for it at age one, others are ready for it at age six. And frankly, without any exception whatsoever, when we get to 13, we think that everything and anything goes. You know, there's only one problem. The halacha didn't think that way. Bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah, 12 and 13, you've reached puberty and you're mature and finished. There's an interesting bit of information that you don't know. From 13 through 18, you're responsible for all the mitzvahs that you can do. From 12, for you gals. But in terms of heavenly punishment for not living up to your responsibility, do you know at what age the good Lord starts to zap you? Any idea? 18. It's an interesting age. What? I know that. You see, now the Rabbanu Shalom was very, the Rabbanu Shalom was very good to you. He didn't lead you down this path of the Jewish life cycle 10 years ago or whatever. But remember, for fun one pays. Ultimately, you got to pay the ticket to get in. All right? There you go. But there's something so incredibly inherent in that statement. Especially today, where we in America have created this no man's land called adolescence. You're an adult because your biological time clock kind of tells you that you're an adult, but you're a kid because you still have to go to school, and only kids do that. You don't go to work, so you're not an adult. You can't say no yet, because you get clobbered with a baseball bat, not with a strap. There's this ambivalence, this milchiks and fleishiks, this day and night period of life called adolescence, where we try to stand on our own two feet, and are told by society, you know, be a man. You're not a kid anymore. Be a grown up woman. You're a woman. You're not a little baby girl. And on the other hand, we are compressed, or we compress these kids into the kind of adolescence that looks like and registers as childhood. We have the same thing here. Who says that just because one has reached puberty and bodily changes start to occur, that you can go ahead and take upon yourself all the responsibilities of an adult human being? Oh yes, there are times. There is a Poland of Holocaust years. There is a Russia of World War I, where at 6 and at 7 and at 8 you came to the shores of Ellis Island and you went to work. At 8 years old you went to work. But these are exceptions. These are not the rule. And so, to end my introduction, it is seemingly what I am saying to myself is, I beg you, in any and every one of the mitzvahs, in any and every one of the halachas, if you find that you are forcing the issue, you are probably wrong. If you find that you're gritting your teeth, you are being counterproductive. As embarrassing as your child will be to you, whether he or she doesn't want to sit, or he or she doesn't want to do, or he or she says something, I kid you not when I say, let it go by. The honey that in ancient times, up until Europe of World War II, the honey that children used to be given on the first letter of the Chumash, or the Siddur, to lick, was far more compelling than all the discipline that you can bring to the lives of your children. It's as simple as that. Give you a simple example. I have a particular hang-up with what you're doing, Peggy, you know, the yarmulkes. No. You may do it. No. Adina sits in my class and she does it also. You can do it. The hang-up is that there are some psychological problems that I have with the size of yarmulke that we have had. Now, I fought the battle valiantly at Young Israel and have lost. The ones who are not initiated in Torah went along with it. It's the ones who sat at a Gemara and learned a couple of pages of Shulchan Aruch were the ones that didn't want to go.
Yeah,
I hear what you're saying, but listen to me carefully. I want to recount for you an incident that occurred in my life. I was no more than 14. Couldn't be more than 14. I came back from camp after having met my first girlfriend, and she knitted a yarmulke for me. I wore it to shul and was reading the Torah that Shabbos morning in my father's shul. The reason that he didn't read the Torah was that he had 3 brisen in the afternoon to walk to, and he just wanted a breather, and so I read the Torah. Whereupon suddenly, a shul a third the size of Young Israel, he gets up, and he comes up and says, and he looks at my head, and he says, a Pepsi Cola bottle top. Interesting. No. Just before I was ready to lay in. But he said it so that I heard it, but enough people also were able to hear it at the same time. And he sat down, and that was it. Never again to say anything. I can tell you clearly that that made its impression on me in such a way that it is lasting. Because remember, those of you who know me, I have told you that in my adolescent years, there wasn't a thing that I said yes to my parents. Everything that they suggested that was substantive in life was an utter no. There was one exception. I was hanging a Venetian blind one morning, and my mother said, I think this kid Leah is a nice kid, and I ultimately married her. All right? That was the only thing I said yes to my parents. And they're alive to testify, thank God. There was a consistent no to everything. And here is one of my very important proofs, and I just don't want to waste your time. One of my very important proofs that a father who had enough trouble raising his own self, an immigrant child, living through depression years, deciding for some strange reason to go ahead and be a rabbi in an area called Flatbush that had nothing but milk farms and goyim 45 years ago. And that was about it. He suffered from me immeasurably with the shenanigans that I pulled. But somehow a little calm joke like that has made its impression all the way down to my professional career in trying to understand and verbalize to myself, what the heck is wrong with these tiny little Pepsi Cola tops that people want to pass off as yarmulkes? There's something there. Surely if it were in Europe, the kid would have been thrown the heck out of the shul. Is there a halacha of yarmulke? Well, forget the halacha. There's far more important things here, and that's the psychology of it. To me, it symbolized my girlfriend's handiwork, and he knew that. That was my new love. Huh? 14 years old, I'm telling you. You hear? Well, thank God I didn't have you for a mother, Rivka. Boy, I'd really be in trouble. Yeah, sure it was a swinger. Yeah, and how? But now you know why. You see? Now you know why you have 3 nice kids. That's all because you are the way you are. That's all. All right? Ich hab gestrascht mein Tate Mama. Listen to me. That when I would be bar mitzvah, I would get married just to get out. Right.
And
that's it. There you go. All right. Another thing. Just another thing. Listen to me carefully. I, 14, 15, So Saturday night, Mitzvah Shabbos, I used to go out.
Dates.
Yeah, that's what it's called, a date. Not figs, dates. All right. Okay? And there are times that I was late, so late, that I wasn't going to come in at 3 o'clock. And so what we did was to stay up all night so that by 7 o'clock Sunday morning, I came straight to shul, dressed to kill. There's no two ways about it. And the man knew that there was nothing to say, absolutely nothing to say. Finished. Once it happened, twice it happened, and he didn't say anything, it didn't happen the third time. Simple as that. This is it. The man has absolutely no heroic tendencies in him. And every one of his children had more years of education in school than he could ever amass. Okay, he's not uneducated, he's not, okay? And nonetheless, there was something there that was absolutely staggering that only appears to me now when I can sit and teach you gals. Okay? These are the thoughts that come to me at this point. These were the thoughts that motivated me to put this this pamphlet together. And in all the art scroll and all the garbage, art scroll, comma, and then there's also garbage. Okay, and all the garbage that's being produced in English to try to take this generation and make us into a veritable saints, tzaddikim, without any flaws, there hasn't been but one pamphlet on how to raise your child. I don't even have it. It's a book. I saw it on the shelves, and it's good. It is good. I'm not talking about Donin's. That's good also. Okay. Donin, there was one other. Okay? But my Lord, there should have been dozens of things at this point. We are an up-and-coming generation. We are baby-bearing at this point. And if there is any segment of Jewish population that needs a Dr. Spock, it's us. It's the Teaneck, the Fairlawns, the Psaics, the Cliftons, the Lakewoods, and so on and so forth.
So why does no one ever do it?
I once asked one of my teachers why a certain Musar book, Musar Sefer, wasn't translated. And he says, it's the devil that has stopped us. And he meant sincerely that there are certain areas that people better want to be ignorant rather than face up to the facts. And you know that this is not a halachic process. It is truly analysis and psychotherapy in its rawest form. Because we all have to face up to ourselves. Simple as that. And some of us want to replicate our children in our own image, and some of us want our children to be different than us. And you are dealing with raw psychology over here. It's the most it's the most tachlis dikke thing that we could ever do. You know, you can't get more intimate, more personal with a person. And when you talk about how to raise that person's child, or how, that's it. It's kind of gutsy. Who knows? Im Yirtzeh Hashem, hopefully, 2 years after having studied and accumulated these sources, maybe just to put together a pamphlet. I'm not saying that's going to be original. There's nothing original in it, other than those insights that I've given you up until now. From here on in, I simply quote the sources. And the sources that I want to quote for you will ask only two questions. Is there an age limit? And is there a need to educate? That's the chinuch business. And if there is a need to educate, at what age must you educate? Simple as that. I don't know if some of you have these sheets at home, but I produced them over 2 years ago in several forms. You see, I promised it 2 years ago that it would become a Torah topic. Well, I tried to go in the order of the Shulchan Aruch. Tzitzis. The talis katan, the tiny talis, should be worn by children from the time that they are able to speak. Now that's what the halacha says. There is your first clue to a fluid kind of yardstick over here. It depends when. But no later than 3 years of age. Yes, ma'am.
I heard that when
It is,
really,
well, that's without question, okay? If they are not toilet trained, they should not wear tzitzis. Because there in itself, there is an aspect of chinuch, of education. But the source that I quote is right over there, and that's the way it's formulated. I'm telling you that it's in the Shulchan Aruch. I give you chapter and verse, volume, chapter and verse, okay? And that's the way it is. So I can't disagree with it. But more importantly, look at that fluid line from the time they start to speak. Nu, mommies, grandmas, when does a child start to speak?
17 months.
17 months? How much? 2.5. How much? 9 months. Okay? So there you are. Okay? Three.
Three, and then only I have this.
I don't care what the halacha says. I still disagree with it because I find with Joshua, who's going to be 4 in August, when he has those long dangling tzitzis that are kosher, not the ones that are not kosher, and goes to the bathroom, he cries half the time.
Because
he can't manage both.
There, but again,
once he makes me take him off when he sits,
you know,
down,
there is your.
I say kindergarten.
It's built in already. If you are going to impose, I mean, you're the best proof of this, for my contention. If you are going to impose it on that child, and every time he's going to cry, do you realize what you're doing? How you're mangling the kid? Remember, he ain't bar mitzvah yet, and she ain't bat mitzvah yet. There are no two ways about it.
Finally somebody told me you tie the tzitzis on the side, and that pulls it up. But it's not worth a neurosis to this kid.
There you go.
I guess the only one in the first.
There is no need for a bracha to be said until later years, when the child is able to recite a bracha. Now, there is something that's not in the Shulchan Aruch. What do you do with a child who is a girl who has 3 brothers? And every night she is found with tzitzis under her pajamas. or a yarmulke under her pillow. Okay? Needless to say, there are some parents who would be entirely horrified. Well, here again, I beg you, a child plays with a doll, and that child happens to be male. Remember, there are certain symbols you are throwing at that child. If a child puts on a tie, and it happens to be part of a male outfit, and she wants to wear daddy's tie, you look and you think. You have second thoughts. But how absurd it would be when a child is looking for these symbols to start creating again the neuroses of, you don't wear it, girls don't wear that. There is some kind of security at such an early age that this child is trying to find. There is some kind of duplication that she is trying to find in the way things are given to her because she sees it in her brothers. You have to be very careful there also. And again, you're not dealing in halacha. You are dealing in something far more explosive, and that is the yeah, go ahead.
You used to have to try and find something, maybe not the tzitzis in a kippah, but some, like Lubavitch, a little girl should light Shabbos candles. It gives her a part of importance, help him up in challah, help her make Shabbos, things like that. And this way it gives her an importance that doesn't completely It doesn't make her feel like she's not doing something or part of.
When the Lubavitcher Rebbe started this business of every little girl lighting a candle, he put it in very simple terms, but very, very, very ominous terms. God forbid there were an atomic holocaust. What is the little child going to remember? If that little child, the orphan, survives that atomic conflagration, let him and her remember the Shema. Let him and her remember that we used to put pennies into a tzedakah box. Let her light candles to bring a little light to a dark world. Misnagdim, those who weren't Lubavitcher, looked at him and laughed. There's only one difference. Those who laughed may have known the halacha. Lubavitcher Rebbe knew life much better. Simple as that. A man is a genius in the psychology of education. A genius. And I don't agree with him on everything he spouts as far as Chassidus is concerned. You remember how I took off when it came to Mila, his preference for circumcision. I'm sorry. Nonetheless, when it comes to an educational genius and the development of a religious child, this man is almost perfection personified. That's it.
The girls light candles and say it's like they're wasting a bracha, but they're really not supposed to light, and they're making
brachas
for nothing.
A woman is chiyuv, quote unquote, to daven once a day. If she wants to daven mincha marv, it's not a bracha lebatala. She can do
not
it.
Not davening, lighting candles.
But
a little girl is not required.
Okay. But it's not a chiyuv Hashem. It's not like she's saying she's actually doing the mitzvah. She's not a chiyuv to do the mitzvah, but she's doing the mitzvah.
However, would that same father or mother,
the angry little boy said Kiddush, who didn't have
to, wait a minute, would say that saying a bracha at 3 years old over milk is a waste? Does a child, isn't there a fallacy there? Isn't there a fallacy there? That's correct. When you do anything that requires a bracha, don't you think you ought to educate a child to that? I hear what you're saying. But remember carefully, Faggy, that here is where the educational genius came in the development of a religious personality. Lubavitcher Rebbe was entirely right. My Leah had a very interesting reaction to this whole thing. The first time, some of you veterans know Osher Kellner, who is, Osher Kellner used to be our Lubavitcher resident emissary here before he got on well in age and stays in Brooklyn. He never married. His father was rabbi of the Hungarian shul downtown on Dayton Avenue. He and his brother both never married. And when he was still able to come, he asked Adina to light candles for him. And my Adina was a tiny little girl. It's at that time that Lubavitcher Rebbe went out on his campaign, and he wanted to get little girls to light candles. And this Osher Kellner doesn't stop at anything. The first reaction Leah had was, "But I'm not dead yet." And then I said to her, "Just a minute, what school were you educated in?" She says, "Stern College." I said, "Go back." She says, "Central." I said, "Go back. Beis Rivka of Lubavitch." I said, "You ought to be ashamed of yourself." However, I tell you clearly that we are dealing in gutsy symbolism over here. These two candles belong to the person whose name Adina bears. She had her candlesticks while she was alive, and she had her name while she was alive, and that was her great-grandmother. Okay? And she lights candles every single Friday night. And there are no two ways about it, every single Erev Shabbos. But that approach, in my humble estimation, and believe me, I don't have the answers, is probably one of the most counterproductive ways of looking at halacha as it was originally intended. I'm not a chassid. And I don't skip any opportunity of pulling the legs of any chassid. Okay? But my lord, what's right is right. This business, you're not allowed to say a bracha because you're not truly required, is halachic fallacy at its worst. Let's go on. I hear what you're saying. I respect your feelings. But remember, Peggy.
She can lie with me.
Just a minute. Remember, Peggy, I accommodated for you and your thinking when you created a revolution in my thinking when it came to Mila.
I'm trying.
I respect your feelings.
Does she have to light her own candle or can she light with me?
She can.
Because I light one for each. I have an extra candle there for each child. If she wants to light, she can certainly light one of the candles.
One of the extra ones.
Yeah.
So your hang up is an additional one that is specifically her own.
Right.
But if she wanted to light one of the candles, would she know that this is the candle that she lit? Would it be distinctive, or she's just helping you?
Right.
Which one?
She's just helping you.
I don't know.
What am I having?
That's all. I hear what you're saying. There is something there. There is a reason for it. And I respect it. I'm going to live with it. But at this point, the only thing I ask of you is whatever policy you do adopt, if she were to come to you and insist that she wants to light her own, Lord, let her light her own.
Of course, she wants to
light her own. You got it. Okay. On, let's move. A child make. No, it should be may make. All right, a child may make the tzitzis in his own talis katan and need not replace them when he is past the age of bar mitzvah. All right? Because after all is said and done, when you make your own, it is your proud arts and crafts project.
Okay, in school they made it, and they give them a thing that's this big under
all right. Okay.
What are you doing if the thing that the tzitzis are on is too small? Can you take them and put them on something else?
You can change them, yes. You can change them. Next, though the halacha is that a child who can use tefillin properly is required to have his own, and that could be at age 8, that could be 7, 9. When was Jeffrey Hakami a Chinik with?
Probably when he was 3.
Yeah. No question. Jeffrey knew how to put on tefillin and could have been trusted with tefillin many years before his bar mitzvah. Many, many years. Nonetheless, our custom today is to have a child start putting on tefillin no more than 3 months before bar mitzvah, but most have the custom of 1 month, and usually the tefillin that you wear are not your own, but you have a used pair which is borrowed, so that when you get your own after bar mitzvah, a major investment, you can then say your own shehechiyanu, like you're supposed to say when you buy a car, and you buy a house, and you buy a $300 suit, and a $500 or a $100 suit, I don't care. These major things deserve shechiyanu. Okay? And the tefillin being such a substantial investment for the child, or for the parents of the child, on behalf of the child, needs a shechiyanu. So have it new and use it new the first time. Okay? Children who know how to, again, I'm sorry for the spelling, how to properly wear a big talus, a talus gadol, should be encouraged to do so. Now here, Peggy, is where, you know, we favor you guys. The Yekis especially want that. Most who come from Poland and Russia do not do that for very interesting reasons. And I think there are more than just halachic reasons there. But the Germans and even the Chofetz Chaim insisted, my God, if you know how to wear a talus, you should wear a talus. So Sfardim do it and Germans do it and the Yekis do it. This opens up the prevalent custom. This opens up for discussion the prevalent custom of not wearing a talis gadol until after marriage, and it has to really be reconsidered. But you have to understand the other side also.
Wait, you say talis gadol?
I'm talking about a regular tolerance.
Because my brother had one, but it was a small
tolerance. No, I'm talking a legal regulation size tolerance, which means by definition, it covers the major part of your body, whatever size you are. Okay? That it comes down to your knees, let's say, which is the major part, whatever size you are. Cute little silk bar mitzvah talus is nothing more than about 150 years or so that it's been around. And the genesis is quite an interesting one. I'm not entirely...
Put on a full-size palace on a kid that just spent $300 on a suit for. I mean, come on.
Oh, okay.
That's a shot, you know.
To cover it all up. I hear what you're saying. All right, but what if the child has to lay in? What if the bar mitzvah boy has to lay in?
They borrow his
folly. Yeah, but it's covered anyway.
Yeah.
All right.
I'll see him put on.
All right. Okay.
Where does the talus?
This silk scarf. has a very interesting history. You know that a talus is a garment for very good reason, and maybe we'll spend a moment on it, that covers most of your body, the overwhelming part of your body. Well, when Reform Judaism started to flourish, they immediately took the dress of the clergyman, of the Lutheran clergyman, and copied it, and all Christian clergymen have a prayer scarf. And so the early German Reform went ahead and folded up the talus into eighths or sixteenths, you know, like a paper airplane. You fold over and over and over, and then that's what became a talus. Once this occurred, back in Poland and in Russia, where reforms started to wear off, this style of a scarf or a talus took hold. What can I say? It is meant as a robe, it's meant as a cape, it is meant as a uniform that covers one's entire body, or nearly the entire body. Let's go on. Shema, tefillah, davening, coming to minyan. When a child is able to talk, the first pasuk of Shema, the famous six words, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, should be taught to him and to her, as well as other short passages such as Modeh Ani and Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe. Thank God, most of our children today do know it by nursery age. And it speaks well. It speaks well. That's it.
They're finished.
Yeah,
my people are also by that age. Because, Matzah was born in Arshavs, you know, when Alan Bickle went in there, gave him bracha and said that to him. Torah, people on a mushroom, walked out. Went home and slept.
No wonder the kid hasn't shut up.
That's
it. I had great jealousy pangs, or better said, pangs of remorse, when I saw your Noah sitting your kids down, and I got to say the Shema, and he sat there, and he said it with them, and sent them off to bed. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things that my kids got shortchanged on. They learned the Shema themselves or from a tape. Okay?
Good old tapes.
Because their father was flying around the country making Jews out of 73,000 kids. And so we survived. Thank God, my kids survived.
That's all. Always been strict on the Maudani I was, but it's more getting ready for in the morning to get it.
Okay, again.
They got it in school.
Yeah, they got it in school. By age 6 or 7, the child should be able to say the entire Shema according to the Shulchan Aruch.
And if they resist?
And if they resist, you are crazy if you push. Don't. By this age, the need to daven morning and evening regularly is important to be taught. When I say the need, it means a routine. But to daven, Listen to me, people. Listen to me. Listen to me. Hold on. Listen to me. I maintain, after 25 years of professional observation, that adults don't have the ability and the patience to sit more than an hour. If that be the case, a child of six shouldn't be imposed upon for more than 3 minutes. Simple as that. The first pasuk of Ashrei, the last pasuk of Ashrei, if it takes 3 minutes, forget about it. The Shema at night, whatever it is. Because the minute you see squirming, that's where you stop. It's as simple as that. That helps. That helps. But don't force. You cannot force davening. It's as simple as that. If an 11-year-old can't sit, or a 14-year-old can't sit, you're crazy to force him. Simple as that. That's all. I told your husband that over and again. Now, however, you have to realize that slowly but surely we're going to have to get to the kid, because otherwise he or she ain't never going to learn it. But don't force. Don't scream. Don't yell. You've got motivate, incentive. Bride. I want to just turn it around in its total reverse, in its opposite. Jeffrey, for instance, is going to live his whole life in a shul. There are no two ways about it. Without question. I mean, his wife is going to give him a bed to go sleep in shul. Simple as that.
He's not going to make any money, but he's going
to
be happy.
Now listen to me carefully. He cannot sit. And what's more, he becomes so incredibly bored. And I'm looking at him since the day he was born, since the day he's been coming to shul. He becomes incredibly bored within 10 or 15 minutes, and often less. Do you know what has kept this kid going? The ability to change different sidurim to the extent that he needed his own chazan sitter, and how poorly he was understood by some adults, thinking that he took the chazan sitter from the chazan stand, and they didn't realize that it was his own, and he suffered there. Now the kid can't sit. But now, by age 14, there isn't a mistake or an inaccuracy in any sitter that he hasn't found. He has gone through and found things in Sidurim that I've been looking at for years, for decades. And he shows me where it's wrong.
Which is kind of better Gemara as well.
Good. Gemara may come later. But if he were stopped, if he were squelched, if he couldn't go through every single one of the 14 different sidurim that exist, my Lord, he would have been hell on earth to live with. Would have been like a bat out of hell during davening. And there's something that he is telegraphing, your Eli Moshe is telegraphing also. Now, I know he's getting on in years, but don't go berserk. Otherwise, that's it. Let's go on. A child may eat before davening. Amen as a response to brachos and kaddish should be taught as early as possible. When you hear a kid yell out amen and can get him to do it in shul and then gets a candy or gets extra wine that Shabbos, it's probably a big mitzvah. Bringing children to shul when they cannot yet sit properly and participate is damage to the child. And that's why it's not correct. Children who disturb the davening should never be forced to come to shul. The problem is that when I... The problem is not even parents. The problem is the organization called the shul. There isn't a church worth its name in this United States of America that doesn't have a nursery for parents to come and for 1 hour be able to spiritually commune with God. I once said that in shul and they were ready to hang me up. At least one man was ready to hang me up. I said, go to church and learn how they get their people to come to pray. And that's what we don't have. Therein rests the fallacy. Yes, you should walk to shul with your children, but if your children cannot sit for more than 5 hours, you should be able to daven, and your children should be cared for upstairs, downstairs, across the street, next door, wherever it is, and that we don't do. So we start forcing the kids to sit, and we create ogres out of them by the time they're 13, so that when they're in their 13s and they're in their 20s, they cluster, the young men and the young gals cluster, and they don't shut their faces 1 minute. And then we turn 20 and turn 30 and we're doing the same thing.
What are you talking about?
All of us. All of us. Excuse me. All of us. All of us. I only am thankful that Elio Hanavi does not walk in on us. He would burn every shul as a haven of idolatry and burn it to the ground. There are few exceptions. Few exceptions.
Cute story. Someone once asked Zakai Center, why there shouldn't be any mixed seating in the shul. You know, why can't it be like a conservative shul? And his answer was, listen, if I was sitting next to, now, wait a minute, if I was sitting next to a very good looking woman, or you were, could you concentrate on what you were doing?
And the children are the same. Why should you be able to concentrate when your children are sitting next to you?
Well,
and
that's
you.
Why I walk the baby child
out of my home. Next, a minor cannot be counted as the tenth one to a minyan. Though some have been lenient with this halacha, especially where there were pre-bar mitzvah boys who were serious participants in the minyan, it is clear that most authorities today reject the leniency. You may have heard that if you hold a chumash or if you hold a sefer Torah, okay. Only in a case where there is no other minyan possible in the entire city or region should the leniency even ever be considered, and even then only the most careful supervision of a competent rov in these matters. This whole ninth one was when you have a town, a derfele, a dorf, that had six families, and out of the six families you'd never be able to have a minyan. You only have nine. So you take the tenth kid and you make him. It's based on some halacha. A minor cannot serve as chazan for certain portions of the davening where you need a minyan. The things that in the Young Israel style of getting children to lead services in these limited portions throughout the davening is not without precedent. I mean, this has been done. But it's only in areas, and only specifically in those areas where whatever you say and whatever you do, you don't need a minyan for that part.
That's my husband.
Okay? Yeah.
Now he comes up here. That is fun. Too bad. No, only to a factor.
Okay. A minor who, God forbid, has to say Kaddish Yosom as an Ovel may do so even without someone else saying Kaddish at the same time. But this does not imply that the minor can, under such circumstances, be part of a minyan, even though you say Kaddish.
What if it's a girl?
Girls may say Kaddish, in my humble estimation. Pardon me? Why not?
Because somebody in my school.
Yeah, I know. But maybe when we get to Avelus, I will certainly speak at length about that. What I just said is surely controversial, but you know, whatever I say, I'm ready to stand behind with two fists.
Well,
yeah,
I can say
Kaddish. Yeah, so. All right. It's a major issue, and when you see all the sources, I don't know, when will we get to the other end of life? We're first starting. It may be another year till we get to the other end of life. I have a major statement to make about that. A minor who is a Kohen should not get up to Duchen on Yom Tov until he reaches the age whereby he knows fully how to Duchen. This is a tough one. Fathers especially, who are Kohanim, want to see their kids standing next to them. Accordingly, even though the general stated age of chinuch, of educating children, is about 6 or 7, in the case of a kohen, a child who is a kohen, the matter is delayed considerably until the minor is close to bar mitzvah age. How close, you ask? 6 months. 7 months. 8 months. Real close. Many kohanim father who give me a hard time on that.
You don't even stand up there with the kid?
No. The kid does not get up because it is a distraction. And I know that we've had to buckle to certain pressures. But remember, I have the source over there. And in this case, I can tell you in the mumbo jumbo, one of the sources that I specifically looked to quote was none other than the sainted Chofetz Chaim, who was a kohen, who had children who were kohanim, who was faced with this problem, and his children did not get up there. Again, because of the sanctity of the mitzvah and its seriousness, not always do you take your children along. When you go to the opera or to the ballet or to a Broadway show, you don't take your children along. Or you want a weekend off at Atlantic City, you leave your children behind. You know, sometimes, huh? Any day. Yes, sir.
How much of a relationship with the children is not normal society, and from my observations, many times they seem to be completely independent of their family and are not close.
Because they're serving other children, that's
right. Yeah, right. Therefore, I wouldn't use that as a role model. What does it mean for someone to know how to daven? Why does a child have to know? What does knowing mean? And if this child, when he becomes 13 years in one day, had the same knowledge of Duchovin that he had 12, 11, 10, let's say, and it didn't satisfy that standard, will we then let him get up to Duchovin anyway? What does the kohen have to know?
It's not a matter of knowing, okay?
Well, that's what
it is a matter of why we bar them. Is a matter of propriety, what we call kavodat tzibur. Okay? A tzibur, a congregation that's worth its name, has got to have distinguished dignitaries leading. And kohanim are distinguished dignitaries at that point. It is not a pre-holiday class program at Hillel Academy, where the goal in such a program is to get all the children involved and all the mommies and all the daddies and all the bubbies and the zadies to come and take pictures. That's not Birchas Kohanim.
What about Shabbos and Yom Tov?
Shabbos, that's not a Yom Tov for what?
To
let them duchen. No. Yeah, I know. I don't care when it is. There are certain things that still we have this issue of kavod hatzibur, and kavod hatzibur demands that there be the highest priority. Those 16 words are dynamite, really. And the only reason that Birchas Kohanim is misunderstood or not understood is because we never took a look at what those 16 words imply. If we truly understood, then all the other heebie-jeebies about Birchas Kohanim would fall away. It is humanism at its highest. It is theology at its deepest. It is brotherly love at its best.
So we're going to come in to say this with no qualifications.
Other than he be a Kohen and he be a God. No. There is qualification that you say it in the original Hebrew because you know it, you understand it, and you've learned the Mefarshim on it. Sofek Kohen. There's no such thing truly as a Sofek Kohen. Depends what? There are things that bar him. But again, this is not a kid's job. I must admit, young Israel style, as holy as it is to me, if the Vilna Gaon came and saw me doing it, he would probably bar me from ever getting up at a pulpit in any shul in this universe. The Anim Zmiros. He refused to allow adults to say it every Shabbos because they were running to Kiddush and they were running to go home to get Shalt, and they didn't say it with enough Kavon and enough Kedusha. So he only left it for Yom Tov. Let's call a halt over here. Im Yetzah Hashem, we'll continue next time, and that'll bring us up to Bar Mitzvah. You see what's coming, what's ahead of you on the third page, aside from what I have listed here. You know, violating Shabbos and Yom Tov, and violating Kashrus or observing Kashrus, benching, saying Kiddush and Havdalah, observance of Yom Tov, this business of shaving and haircuts and payos. What if, God forbid, a child has to mourn? I will leave that when we get going. Business practices, that's a very interesting one. How do you deal with your children and their gift money? All right? Or their inheritance money from a great aunt or a great grandfather, so on. There's some interesting things that we don't know about. Testimony. If a child tells me that he saw a piece of non-kosher meat going into a butcher shop, and that's the only testimony that I have, can I take the child's word for it? Damages to another's property. I mean, al pi halacha, we know what, if you damage, you've got to pay. And what is a child's dress, proper dress and attire? These are some of the things that I hope we're able to get to. And then that'll bring us up to Bar Mitzvah and Bat Mitzvah.